When John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath was first published 75 years ago today, it was not universally embraced. Some questioned how true a picture it painted of the Dust Bowl era. The book was banned and even burned in parts of the country, but it has endured. Today, this novel about the Great Depression and the troubles of the Joad family who flee Oklahoma for a new life in California remains widely read. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, Steinbeck's take on the devastating effects of poverty has new meaning in these times.
Much has been said and written about the Dust Bowl. It's been well documented in photos and films, in books and music. But if you want to get a visceral feel of how it all began and of the way it affected the people who experienced it, you need go no further than the opening pages of The Grapes of Wrath.
Men stood by their fences and looked at the ruined corn, drying fast now, only a little green showing through the film of dust. The men were silent, and they did not move often. And the women came out of the houses to stand beside their men, to feel whether this time the men would break. The women studied the men's faces secretly, for the corn could go as long as something else remained.
When the book was first published in 1939, it was a bestseller. Susan Schillinglaw, professor of English at San Jose State University and author of the book On Reading the Grapes of Wrath, says it also came under fierce attack.
Part of the shock initially was resistance to believing that there was that kind of poverty in America. Other people thought that Steinbeck was a communist, and they didn't like the book because they thought that that collective action that the book is moving towards, because it really is moving from I to we, was threatening to sort of American individualism.
As powerful as the book is in its portrayal of the Dust Bowl era, Schillinglaw says The Grapes of Wrath cannot be contained by its setting. She believes Steinbeck created a timeless myth.
He saw dispossession as a theme and as a story much larger than, you know, the California story. So I think he always knew what he was about in terms of those sort of mythic parallels. Tom Joad's exit from the book, for example, you know, he exits saying, I'll be there wherever people are hungry. So he kind of says throughout time, there's going to be a need for me. And that takes the book out of the 1930s.
Now Tom said, Mom, wherever there's a cop, beating a guy, forever hungry and born baby cry, where there's a fight against blood and hatred in the air, look for me, Mom, I'll be there.
Tom Joad's final words to his mother have echoed down the years, driven not in small part by Henry Fonda's portrayal of Joad in the film version of the book.
I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.
Last fall, the California-based Steinbeck Center sent three artists on the road to retrace the journey the Joads took from Oklahoma. One of them was filmmaker P.J. Palmer.
You know, it gets hot out there, and then there's thunderstorms and crazy wind, and then it snowed. I mean, every type of weather you can think of we experienced in those 10 days. It's not a comfy ride. And so I don't understand how they pulled it off in the 1930s. Must have been really, really crazy.
Palmer is finishing up a documentary on the trip.
We really wanted to come out and sort of take the temperature of the country again. Steinbeck did it back in the 30s, and we decided to take that trip to sort of see what things are like now.
Much has changed over the decades, Palmer says. The land has been restored. They didn't see any destitute families on the side of the road. But they still came across many people struggling to survive. Poverty and homelessness persist.
We've met a lot of people out of work. We met people who were kind of going through their own personal dust bowls. If it wasn't that they were unemployed or in an environmental disaster, they still had their own personal traumas and tragedies that they were working through.
Palmer interviewed some of the people they met along the way, a single dad caring for his son with cancer, a woman who lost both parents as a child, trying to start life again after leaving prison, migrant workers who now live in the same camps the Joads found in California. These and other stories are told in his film.
Being a single parent and going back to school, it's mainly just we're getting by until I graduate. So that's what we do.
I was basically on the streets from before light till long after dark, looking for a job and trying to survive the hunger.
You alone can do it, but you can't do it alone. And I think that sums up my life.
Professor Susan Schillinglaw says many people today can identify with the Grapes of Wrath.
People read their own stories into it because it's really about poverty. It's about haves and have-nots. And that story is getting increasingly urgent. You know, when we talk about the 98% of Americans who seem to be losing ground, and this is a story about people losing ground with every step of the way along, you know, Route 66. That's a story that seems like really very contemporary.
The book, says filmmaker P.J. Palmer, is also a story of survival and resilience, a powerful plea for people to work together with a sense of shared responsibility for those who have fallen on hard times.
The scary part is that much of what happened we're forgetting. There's a reason why the New Deal happened. You know, I do understand that the country had gone through an enormous environmental disaster. It had gone through a major depression. Hopefully we don't have to go through that again, but we still have these huge problems with people unable to work or find a job and people who don't have a home. And we're sort of still stripping things back. Politically, is that okay? I kind of feel like, did you guys read the book? Did you see the movie? Do you remember what happened?
75 years later, The Grapes of Wrath still is not universally loved. It remains one of the most frequently banned books in this country. But it's also a powerful reminder of a past that no one really wants to see repeated. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Author Gabriel Garcia Marquez has died at the age of 87. The Colombian-born writer is best known for his novel 100 Years of Solitude. In 1982, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, as the citation read, for his novels and short stories in which the fantastic and the realistic are combined in a richly composed world of imagination reflecting a continent's life and conflicts. NPR's Mondelit del Barco has this tribute to his life and to his writing.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez was and remains Latin America's best-known writer, spinning epic tales since the 1940s, the master of a style known as magic realism.
Hemos creído que detrás de la realidad de los racionalistas hay todavía mucho espacio.
He told NPR in 1984 that behind the reality there's still a lot of space where some things cannot be explained. His novels were filled with miraculous and enchanting events and characters, love and madness, wars, politics, dreams, and death. And everything he had written, Garcia Marquez said, he knew or heard before he was 8 years old.
La memoria que yo tengo era de un boomtown.
Garcia Marquez grew up on the coast of Colombia in Aracataca, which became a boomtown after a U.S. fruit company arrived. He was born there in 1927. He said his writing was forever shaped by the grandparents who raised him as a young child.
There was a real dichotomy in me because, on one hand, during the day, there was the world of my grandfather, a world of stark reality, of civil wars he told me about since he had been a colonel in the last civil war. And then, on the other hand, there was the world of my grandmother, which was full of fantasy, completely outside of reality.
His grandfather, grandmother, their stories, and their town became the raw material for his most famous work, 100 Years of Solitude. Here's a passage read by actor Hector Elizondo.
All the inhabitants ran out into the street and saw Aureliano Triste waving from a locomotive. And in a trance, they saw the flower-bedecked train which was arriving for the first time 8 months late. The innocent yellow train that was to bring so many ambiguities and certainties, so many pleasant and unpleasant moments, so many changes, calamities, and feelings of nostalgia to Macondo.
I think 100 Years of Solitude is a towering book of enormous influence worldwide, and it is also as close as one could get to a perfect book.
Ilan Stavins wrote a biography of the author's early years, including the time Garcia Marquez spent as a newspaper journalist.
He was a nobody. He was really an unknown journalist and author of short stories, just beginning to make his career. He was, at that point, coming close to 40. And fame and celebrity and this standing that he has as a literary giant of the 20th century really all coalesced in that particular moment when the book was published.
It was a unique moment in time, and 100 years of solitude struck a chord, says another Garcia Marquez biographer, Gerald Martin.
You had to be in the 1960s. You had to be in the world of the Beatles and Third World Revolution, psychedelia, lots of things, to understand now what impact the first page of that book had. It just seemed to be a kind of writing that everybody had been waiting for. They didn't know they were waiting for it till it came. It was just one of those zeitgeist things.
Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice.
The first two lines, the first time you read them, you just felt, I've read this before. Where's this come from? Which is what he felt when he first himself thought up the first line of the book.
Garcia Marquez was among what's known as Latin America's literature boom of the 1960s and 70s, along with Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes and Peruvian author Mario Vargas Llosa, with whom Garcia Marquez differed sharply in his political beliefs. The Colombian got his leftist leanings from his grandfather. They too shaped his writing.
Yo trabajo fundamentalmente sobre la realidad que conozco, sobre la realidad de América Latina.
I write mostly about the reality I know, about the reality of Latin America. Any interpretation of this reality in literature must be political. I cannot escape my own ideology. When I interpret reality in my books, it's inseparable.
His 10 novels include Autumn of the Patriarch, about a Latin American dictator, but they also include the lifelong love story of two elderly people married to others. Love in the Time of Cholera was made into a film in 2007.
Fermina. I have waited for this opportunity for 51 years, 9 months, and 4 days. That is how long I have loved you, from the first moment I cast eyes on you until now.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez titled his 1982 Nobel Prize acceptance speech, The Solitude of Latin America.
We, the inventors of tales, who will believe anything, feel entitled to believe that it is not yet too late to engage in the creation of a new and sweeping utopia of life.
In his acceptance speech, Garcia Marquez spoke about Latin America's wars, military coups, dictatorships, and ethnocide.
Garcia Marquez is speaking about all the people who are marginal to history, who have not had a voice.
Chilean novelist Ariel Dorfman told NPR the speech was one of the author's most important messages to the world.
He gives a voice to all those who died. He gives a voice to all those who are not born yet. He gives a voice to Latin America.
Where no one will be able to decide for others how they die, where love will prove true and happiness be possible, and where races condemned to 100 years of solitude will have, at last and forevermore, a second opportunity on earth.
Colombian author Gabriel Garcia Marquez died today. I'm Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Two historically based graphic novels have caught our book critic's eye this week. Here's Maureen Corrigan's review of A Bentel Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters.
A Bentel Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters are two New York stories. That's why I'm combining them in this review. Not because, as some purists still think, they're lesser works of literature because they're graphic novels. If Egyptian hieroglyphics, the Bayeux Tapestry, and Art Spiegelman's 1991 classic, Mouse, haven't yet persuaded the high art holdouts of the value of stories told in visual sequence, nothing I say now about these two books is likely to convince them. Which is a shame, because A Bentel Brief by Liana Fink and The Harlem Hellfighters by Max Brooks and illustrated by Kanan White are two of the most powerful books I've read so far this year. A Bintel Brief takes its title from the column of the same name that first appeared in 1906 in the Yiddish-language newspaper, The Daily Forward. Literally translated as a bundle of letters, the Bintel Brief was an advice column in which Jewish immigrants new to New York City could ask practical questions as well as give voice to their loneliness, dreams, and fears. The Forward's legendary editor, Abraham Kahn, answered the letters himself, and the column made the Forward the most widely read Yiddish-language newspaper in the world. Author and illustrator Liana Fink places herself in this story as a young woman who opens a notebook of old clippings from the Forward and finds herself confronted with the cranky apparition of Abraham Kahn. Together they walk the streets of the Lower East Side, past abandoned synagogues and pickle factories, talking about the immigrants' letters. Fink has adapted 11 actual letters from the Forward, and they range from the Daffy, a barber obsessed by a nightmare in which he slits the throat of a customer, to the Tormented. I'm thinking especially of the final letter in this collection, written by a desolate young woman whose fiancé has died in the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire of 1911. Fink's illustrations intensify the emotional resonance of these letters, invoking the buoyant magic of Marc Chagall, but also sometimes descending into the cramped world of the tenements. One page here, for instance, shows a couple despairing over their infertility, sinking and dissolving into their old sofa. Wisely, Fink appreciates that the power of the Bintel Brief stories derives from the fact that they're eternally open-ended. What happened to that mad barber or that young man in Brooklyn who didn't want to bring his father over from the old country, or that baker cursed with a two-timing wife? Kahn gave them his best advice, but we'll never know if they took it. The Harlem Hellfighters begins and ends in New York, but spends years mired in the trenches and battlefields of France. That's because Max Brooks and Kanan White have dramatized the history of the 369th Infantry Regiment during World War I. This African-American regiment, called the Men of Bronze by their French allies and the Harlem Hellfighters by their German enemies, spent 191 days in combat, longer than any other American unit, white or black, and were one of the most decorated units in the entire American Expeditionary Force. They helped make the world safe for democracy, even if, as one Hellfighter in this story ruefully says, democracy wasn't exactly safe back home. As Brooks and White detail in panel after vivid panel, the Hellfighters fought a two-front war against the enemy over there and racial prejudice everywhere, but particularly from their fellow Americans and their own government. The Hellfighters' story stretches from enlistment halls in Harlem to training camps in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where these soldiers were handed broomsticks instead of rifles and were confronted with signs in local shops that read, "No dogs or coloreds." The Hellfighters were deployed to Europe quietly, while the rest of the New York National Guard, the so-called Rainbow Division, were given a grand parade send-off by the city. The Hellfighters were told that black is not a color of the rainbow. This is a stunning work of historical recovery and a very graphic novel. Bodies explode, rats feed on corpses, men are strafed and gassed. It's not pretty, but the in-your-face style of the Harlem Hellfighters is suited to dramatizing a crucial part of American history that hasn't been thrust forcefully enough into our collective faces.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Bintel Brief and the Harlem Hellfighters.
This is Fresh Air. The crime novelist Giorgio Serbonenko, who died in 1969, has been called the godfather of Italian noir. His 1960s series, The Milano Quartet, focusing on a doctor-turned-detective, has been long unavailable in the U.S. Melville House plans to release the whole series, and the first volume, A Private Venus, is just out. Our critic at large, John Power, says Serebrennikov is the real down-and-dirty deal.
Although there's no rigid dividing line, fans of the crime genre generally fall into two camps. There are those who prefer stories which, after titillating us with dark transgressions, end by restoring order. The show Law and Order is an aptly named example. And then there are those who prefer stories which, even after the mystery is solved, leave you swimming in the murk. Think Chinatown. This is the male-dominated realm of noir. While the noir sensibility can be found all over the globe, it's one of the key signatures of the modern, some countries have a particular knack for its moody blend of violence and bleakness. One of them is Italy, where corruption and world-weary cynicism are almost an ancient birthright. This patrimony has given us such present-day noir favorites as Massimo Carlotto, Carlo Lucarelli, and Maurizio Di Giovanni, all available in English from Europa editions. I'd urge you to read them. But you should also look back to the 1960s and read the writer these guys would acknowledge as the father of Italian noir. His name was Giorgio Serebrennikov, who was born in Kiev in 1911, grew up in Rome, and worked for decades as a journalist in Milan. Serebrennikov's lasting achievement is known as the Milano Quartet, which does for that city some of what James Ellroy does for L.A. The first of these novels, A Private Venus, has just been released by Melville House in a crackling new translation by Howard Curtis. I read it in a single sitting. Like all good noirs, A Private Venus centers on a disillusioned loner, in this case Duca Lamberti, a loner with good reason to be disillusioned. Once a doctor, he was imprisoned for murder after compassionately helping a dying woman kill herself. Now free but forbidden to practice medicine, Duca gets hired by a Milanese plastics mogul who, like most rich men in noir, is a respectable creep. The assignment is to straighten out the mogul's 22-year-old son, Davide, who has gone from being a normal, spoiled heir to a guilty, taciturn young alcoholic. Duca knows something has driven Davide to such self-destructive straits, probably a woman. And so he sets about looking into what changed him, enlisting help from a police superintendent who is friends with Duca's cop father. The investigation takes him from chic nightclubs into the sinister underbelly of fashion-mad Milan, where pretty young women exist to have their bodies stripped, sold, and carved up by thugs. Along the way, Duca befriends a smart, attractive young woman, Livia, who has her own reasons for bringing the bad guys down. Suffice it to say that everything does not turn out perfectly. Through it all, Duca remains a terrific, brooding, conflicted character, an accidental detective. On the one hand, he believes that, and I quote, hope is a kind of secret vice that nobody ever managed to rid themselves of completely. On the other, he's a decent man righteously disgusted by evil. He fights, however hopelessly, for some form of justice. Both here and in the Quartet's even better next volume, Traitors to All, which is coming out in June. Now, Serebrennikov was not Italy's first great crime novelist. That honor goes to the Sicilian Leonardo Sciascia, who is frankly a much greater writer. But Serebrennikov was a trailblazing radical who pulled the mask off a whole era. Even as 60s Italy was supposedly flowering around him, people finally getting richer and living la dolce vita, Serebrennikov wasn't convinced. As a journalist, he'd seen the poverty and gangsterism behind the fashionable facade of Milan, the rich, conservative northern city that prides itself on being cleaner than the unruly south. Of course, noir isn't truly noir if the pain and darkness it depicts can be eliminated by, say, electing the right political candidate. Noir requires a metaphysical dimension, a sense of life's enveloping, incurable soiledness that you find in Jim Thompson and in the so-called hard novels of Georges Simenon. Serebrennikov has this cosmic vision in spades, and so does Duca Lamberti, who lives in a fallen world where moral chaos keeps devouring law and order. Duca knows that even when the guilty lose, the innocent still don't win.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue Daily. He reviewed A Private Venus by Giorgio Serebrennikov. You can follow our blog on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. You'll find staff-curated photos, videos, interview highlights, and a look into what's happening behind the scenes.
For the past decade, Pakistan has faced war, political instability, and the rise of religious extremism. But those crises have also had this unintended consequence. They fueled a new generation of Pakistani writers and artists. For many of them, art has become a way to reflect on the turmoil and to push back. NPR's Bilal Qureshi recently visited the country's cultural capital, Lahore, and he brings us this story.
Aisha Jalal is a leading historian of Pakistan, and she says the violence of recent years has left deep scars.
I think it's underestimated what Pakistan has gone through in terms of the internal threat, the narrowing of public discourse, the closing of the mind.
Terrorism, kidnappings, and daily tension have become the new normal, according to journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's charted the rise of the Taliban for decades, and he says they've descended from the mountains into the urban centers of Pakistan, infiltrating society, ideas, and culture.
It's discussed every day. When I meet my friends, I mean, that's literally what we talk about.
And yet, amid a pervading sense of insecurity, the city of Lahore remains the art capital of Pakistan. It's a big sprawling place with a jewel box of an old city at its center, known for its ancient mosques and palaces, its painters and poets. Novelist Mohsen Hamid says history feeds creativity here.
For example, you know, amazing art universities like the National College of Art, different languages together, a history of many different cultures and peoples, from the Greeks to the Arabs to the British invading over millennia, creating this kind of multi-layered society.
Culture is everywhere, says Nussi Jamil.
If you go to the old city at night, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, it's buzzing with life. And these are people who are sitting down, reciting poetry, listening to some little singer or the others. And despite everything, these things have continued in Lahore.
Jamil wanted to draw on that energy to celebrate the arts in her city. So she helped organize the Lahore Literary Festival. The gates to the festival were bathed in yellow and red fabrics, but it felt more like a technicolor entrance to a high-security compound than your neighborhood book talk. Metal detectors, armed guards, barbed wire greeted all visitors. Nothing was visible from outside. Ambulances were parked nearby. But inside the fortified border, the festival grounds were warm and inviting. Venues were decorated with balloons and banners in spring colors. And artist Salima Hashmi says it was the perfect way to begin a new season.
People shrugged off fear. And they were just there and they were enjoying themselves and they were listening and they were talking and they were laughing. But apart from that, they wanted to see one another. They wanted to feel, oh, there are a whole lot of us.
More than 45,000 people, in fact, attended the free event over 3 days. They came to hear talks in Urdu, Punjabi, and English.
So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming to the stage Mr. Vikram Sekhat.
Artist Abdullah Qureshi says he was struck by how young the audiences were, lounging on the grass between panels, stalking writers for autographs and selfies.
It was beautiful to see young people doing that because they really don't get that opportunity enough. I mean, imagine in the absence of cultural activities like that, what kind of negativity brews in the head and what kind of ideas are being fostered because they're not seeing any hope. So culture provides that also.
But novelist Mohsen Hamid says just getting access to culture in Pakistan has become a real struggle.
Pakistan does feel sometimes like it's behind the Iron Curtain. It's very difficult for Pakistanis to get visas to go abroad, and it's very difficult to get people to come to Pakistan. You know, and the people who come tend to be, you know, security and intelligence types of folks. So getting writers and intellectuals from all over the world to come and engage in public in conversations that lots of people can listen to and ask questions at is refreshing but also very unusual in Pakistan.
The Lahore Literary Festival was not an overt protest against the Taliban. Instead, it was a showcase for a parallel Pakistan, one that's inclusive, creative, and thriving, despite the failure of government and society to build a stable country. Historian Aisha Jalal says that kind of collective failure fuels great art.
If you look at Latin America, you'll see that art has flourished in the most coercive authoritarian regimes, and Pakistan is no different. I think collective failure is matched often by personal, individual success, spectacular success. Those are not unusual, and in Pakistan, I think we've had a collective failure on many scores, and yet there have been individuals who have done work of great brilliance in the world of art, in the world of literature, music.
Lahore's singers are stars across the region. Visual artists Shazia Sikandar and Imran Qureshi have shown at the world's leading museums. Pakistani novelists are bestsellers from a country where almost anyone can recite their favorite poem to you.
Mori Araj Suno Dastagir Peer Mori Araj Suno Mori Araj Suno
words of Faz Ahmed Faz became the rallying cry for another generation of Lahoris. Faz was a poet and an activist, and he was imprisoned for his work. Salima Hashmi is his daughter and the former principal of the National College of Art.
The fine arts or writing or music, these were not things to just glamorize life. They were not the icing on the cake of life. These were things that gave voice to people who were voiceless. I believe in oppressive time, culture is political work.
And Hashmi says now, with the Taliban at the gates, art is again political work. On the first night of the festival, I fought through a frenzied crowd for a seat to see dancer Naheed Siddiqui. She was once banned from performing in Pakistan. The idea of a woman presenting a kind of dance that drew from Hindu and Muslim traditions was deemed officially unacceptable. Siddiqui says this year felt different.
It left me really like so peaceful and at rest because, you know, finally people are walking with us. And they were saying everything they had to in their appreciation.
Peace is not a reality in Pakistan today, but perhaps it is those who imagine for a living, the country's artists, who can help a new generation imagine a new future.
There's a real thirst for this in this society, and that is the great hope for Pakistan.
Again, historian Aisha Jalal.
Despite all that has happened, despite the supposed Talibanization of the mind, the resistance strands have also been there. And unlike in the past, there's a more concerted attempt now, not least because of the negative profiling of Pakistan globally, that Pakistanis want to be noticed on the scene. They want to make an impact.
And for Nussi Jameel, who helped organize the Lahore Literary Festival, audiences made an impact by just showing up.
I think what the Literary Festival has done has actually suddenly woken people up that, okay, the threat is there, but what the hell, life goes on, we will come.
Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.